This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. North Carolina is home to a growing number of startup companies, and all of them are trying to stay ahead of today's constant need for innovation. Of course, the upside of innovation is business opportunity. Cities and states across this region are redirecting investments and trying to claim the title of the Silicon Valley of the South. The downside, however, is job displacement. As computer software becomes more sophisticated, more of our jobs are vulnerable to automation. So, how do we prepare for the rise of computers in the workforce? That is the theme of this year's Emerging Issues Forum at North Carolina State University. The two-day event kicks off next Monday in Raleigh. Martin Ford is the keynote speaker at this year's forum. He's the founder of a software technology firm in Silicon Valley and the author of the book Rise of the Robots, Technology and the Threat of a Jobless Future. Martin, welcome to the State of Things.
Thanks very much for having me.
Also with us, Anita Brown Graham. She is the director of the Institute for Emerging Issues at NC State University. Welcome back, Anita.
Thanks so much, Frank. Always good to be with you.
Martin, we've been talking about machines taking over our jobs since the dawn of the Industrial Revolution. Has the conversation changed much, and how?
Well, as you say, it's a conversation that's been going on literally for 200 years now, since the Luddites back in England. But, you know, the alarm has been raised many times, and it's always turned out to be a false alarm. In my book, I talk a little bit about the Triple Revolution Report, which was a formal report presented to President Johnson back, you know, 50 years ago in 1964, arguing that this was going to happen. So the idea has been around for a while, but I really believe there's strong evidence to suggest we're finally at the point now where the technology is really there and is becoming so broad-based that it's really just going to scale across a lot of different industries and occupations and have a really dramatic impact.
Well, the reason it has been a false alarm is that because while we can see the changes that are taking place, jobs that become obsolete by technology, we sort of fail to imagine the new possibilities that it creates for people. And that's been sort of the failure and what's created this, as you say, sense of false alarm. So why is this any different? Why don't we just apply ourselves to new jobs once the old ones are taken over by digital technology?
Right. Well, I think to some extent that will happen. And as you say, that's what's happened in the past. Probably the classic example would be what happened in agriculture. I mean, it used to be that most people worked on farms. And then, of course, farm machinery came in and disrupted that completely. Millions of jobs disappeared. But then people found other jobs in manufacturing and later in the service sector. The problem this time is that the disruption is going to be much more broad-based. This time it's going to hit every industry more or less in parallel. And for the first time, machines and computers are really beginning to take on cognitive tasks. They're beginning to, in a limited sense, think. And that means that they're really encroaching on that fundamental capability that so far has allowed people to, you know, stay ahead of technology. So it's not just about machines displacing muscle power anymore. It's really about brain power, and that's really what's different, I think.
So is that, I mean, in some ways that can be good news, but that's also been the false, if not the alarm, the false promise in all of this for all of these years has been, once we can get machines to do these sort of unlovable tasks, we will be free to enjoy our lives. That hasn't happened either. Somebody else owned those machines, and it turns out we're still working, if not as hard, harder than we've ever worked before. So actually, we have failed to reap the benefits of any of the technology, we, meaning most of us in this population, not there are some of us who have, but most of us haven't. So what about that? Are we able to relax and let robots do our work while we go to the Riviera, or what?
Well, I mean, that's the very optimistic view that we might hope for, and as you say, people in the past have sort of foresaw that. I mean, John Maynard Keynes, the famous economist, way back in the 1930s, wrote an essay about what things would look like 100 years from now, and he thought maybe people would only be working 15 hours a week because we'd have this kind of leisure economy. I mean, it's possible that things could work out that way, but obviously there's a distributional issue there. You know, consider all the people that are right now working in the fast food industry. I mean, how could they possibly survive working 15 hours a week? You know, as it is, they have to string together two or three jobs just to get by. So we have a real problem with the distribution of income and the fact that, as you say, all the machines are really owned by capitalists, essentially by the people at the very top of the income distribution. So if we want to have that optimistic future where machines do the work and we have more leisure, more time for other things, we got to figure out a way to solve that problem.
All right. Well, Anita, let me ask you, at the Institute for Emerging Issues, you've been taking a look at job vulnerability in North Carolina. How many jobs, I mean, how does this issue and this question play into the question that you've been looking at, which is vulnerability, those people whose livelihoods are at stake?
So, Frank, we've copied in some ways a national study looking at the 39 occupations most vulnerable to technological disruption and found, based on our index, that about 70% of those jobs that are in North Carolina actually are vulnerable to being lost to automation. So this is a big issue for us. And of course, you know as well as most, a lot of those jobs in absolute numbers are in urban centers where I think Martin is right. There will be new jobs created to replace them. It's actually the more rural places that will lose fewer jobs that you worry about more, because the absolute impact or the relative impact of the loss of those jobs will be huge.
And how so? Are you able to predict, and maybe I'll ask you this first, Anita, and then Martin, get a kind of a bigger picture nationally. So who's going to lose their jobs and what's going to happen to them? Can they be retrained? Are the schools part of the answer here?
We looked occupation by occupation. And obviously, as Martin has suggested, there's the question of whether jobs will be completely eliminated. And then the related question of whether the skills that will be needed in those jobs will be so changed by automation that the people who currently hold them will be rendered obsolete. The challenge for North Carolina, and quite frankly for the nation, is to figure out how you reskill people fast enough to be able to do the things that only humans can do and get advantage of all of the productivity that automation offers.
Yeah, but Martin, your book and your research suggest, and I think there's a lot of research out there, that this question of only humans can do, there's less and less of that. I mean, as you point out in your book, computers are now able to perceive in ways, and that used to be our comparative advantage over computers. We're losing that, aren't we?
That's right. I mean, the most important thing that's happening is really the technology that's referred to as machine learning, and it's the ability of smart software and machines to learn, basically to adapt and to learn and to figure out how to do things much in a limited sense, at least the way people can, and that's a technology that's going to be truly disruptive. And the thing is that it scales across all occupations and industries. So although you can, you know, it may be useful to look at particular occupations and ask which ones are more likely to be automated, the more general and important story is that this is coming for virtually everything. And the really important distinction that people should focus on is, are you doing something that is on some level routine and repetitive and predictable? And if the answer to that is yes, and it really doesn't matter what industry or even how much education you have, if you're doing something that's relatively predictable based on what you've done in the past, then eventually it's very likely that there'll be technology that will be able to do at least a great deal of what you're doing.
Well, but go ahead, Anita.
I was going to say, I couldn't agree with that more. It seems as we've gone across North Carolina talking to people who are leading companies and civic leaders in communities, it's very easy to close your eyes and see retail salespeople losing their jobs and the people who are serving at fast food restaurants being rendered obsolete to kiosks. It's harder for people to imagine what all of this means for so-called white-collar jobs. And yet it is clear that things that accountants do, things that lawyers and their legal assistants do, in fact, things that doctors do, can be automated. I do think it's important to recognize, though, that just because something can be automated doesn't mean that it will be. For example, we know that artificial intelligence allows some machines to do a really great job of diagnosing some medical conditions. But my guess is it will be a while before any of us want to go into the doctor's office and have a machine be the one to deliver the bad news about our diagnosis.
Right. But again, it really raises questions about what that new job is.
Absolutely.
That comfort and how much they get paid and whether they can make a living comforting you while this machine takes a blood test and tells you exactly how long you have to live. But the other question too, Martin, that Anita points out, CEOs' jobs. I mean, what they do is take a look at how their investments are going and how to cut costs and, you know, how to keep wages low. Well, you know, we can get computer programs to do that, and we can get computer programs to program computers so that people in the information industry who are now creating programs will be obsolete very soon because computers can figure out their own fixes based on the repetitive use of the program, right? I mean, in a sense.
Right. I mean, there are many areas that are going to be subject to automation, and it should be said that in general, we're not talking necessarily about the automation of entire jobs or occupations, but really tasks within that job. But, I mean, if you can automate half of what two people are doing, then it's pretty easy to see how that can be consolidated into one job. So that's sort of the path that it takes. And the other point that Anita said is also true, that, you know, certainly jobs that can be automated won't always be automated. And certainly the power that particular individuals have in those jobs has something to do with it. So we probably need to worry a bit less about CEOs' jobs being automated because, you know, CEOs aren't going to be too keen on that. The same is probably true of doctors. But the people I worry the most about in terms of more educated white-collar people are the people that, you know, occupy seas of cubicles inside office towers, you know, the mid-level analysts and mid-level managers. Those people don't have a lot of power to prevent this from happening, and I think that we're going to see a huge impact there.
What about education and the role that plays? Again, this is a kind of a complicated question and one that's facing our universities right now. There's a strong emphasis on entrepreneurialism and entrepreneurism and really a kind of vocational approach, preparing our students for the next generation. But it seems to me that that's, you know, in many cases fraught because you're always a kind of a half step behind. On the other hand, Anita, if we prepare them only as critical thinkers, that sometimes puts you in the crosshairs politically. So I wonder what this means, what this revolution means in terms of planning at, let's say, institutions of higher education.
Well, it's difficult on both the individual and institutional level. I heard a chancellor recently say that as many as half of the students currently on his campus are preparing themselves for first jobs that don't exist mm-hmm. today. So if you think about that, it conjures up all sorts of scary thoughts on how you prepare your kids to go through college and what you tell them they ought to do in terms of majors. But I think the real pressure institutionally is recognizing that these changes, these disruptions are going to come so quickly that we need to have a workforce delivery system, which includes our institutions of higher education, that are able to reskill people much more quickly than is currently the case. Part of the reason we're hosting this conversation next week is to say to North Carolina, if we think a little bit differently about our workforce development system, we can probably get ahead of some of these changes and put in place some infrastructure to support our people.
Surprising statistic that I think your institute, Anita, turned up is the fact that that a majority of students as of 2 years ago at community colleges already had bachelor's degrees. Am I right about that?
So it's interesting to see how many of our students who have four-year degrees are going back to school to engage in some particular vocation. And what's perhaps even more interesting than that statistic is the recognition that that's going to happen more and more. So that as people see opportunities and seek to seize those opportunities in the labor market, they're going to be out there looking for quick ways to build on the skills they already have and make themselves more competitive.
What does for Martin Ford, what do you think this means for higher education and the way it should be, if need be, restructured to meet the demand? Demands of the coming revolution?
You know, I think that the most important thing we need to emphasize is that we need to instill this belief that the most important thing is really to learn to learn, to be flexible in the future, to have this ability to move to another area. I mean, there's absolutely no doubt that a lot of students are right now preparing for occupations that are going to disappear. So, you know, my sense is that in some ways we're being too vocational. You know, we're preparing people for things that are very specific and those things may not be around too long. So, I mean, that's the general advice that I give to students is that, you know, first of all, don't prepare for something that's routine and predictable in nature, even if that thing requires lots of education. And an extreme example of that would be becoming a radiologist, a medical doctor that looks at medical images. I mean, that's a job that takes a terrific amount of education, but it's subject to, you know, it's going to be subject to automation, I think, in the relatively near future, probably. So, I mean, the important thing is to emphasize creativity, to do things that are unpredictable, and to be extraordinarily flexible, to be able to move to new areas down the line, because there's no doubt that a lot of opportunities are going to disappear.
You know, it's interesting that we talk about this as a problem and a challenge and a threat to us all, because, again, when Keynes wrote that piece about the future and having more leisure, being a society of leisure, it was the technology was always a promise. And what's been lost, again, is something we referenced earlier, is that the people who owned the benefits of technology, and as we know, since the mid-70s, but definitely in the 1980s, productivity, which means how cheaply you can produce a product, versus wages, were always in lockstep, and now they aren't. The workers aren't getting the benefit of productivity changes or the technology. It seems to me that it would not be a threat to any of us to have new technology if we all benefited by the advances, Martin.
That's right. I mean, and that's really the critical issue for us, I think, is that historically, without question, you know, technology has made us better off. I mean, that's the reason that all of us today, even average people, are probably much better off, have a much better life than a really rich person, you know, 100 years ago because of what technology has done. And I continue to believe in that. I think it's the only path forward. I mean, the last thing we want to do is say, let's halt technology, let's stop it. Because to do that is really to say to our children and grandchildren, you know, you're not going to be any better off than we are. And that's not what we want to do. But what we want to do is find a way to adapt to this so that everyone can continue to share in that prosperity.
No, but it's interesting. I mean, if you think about the technological advances just in your lifetime, Anita, or in mine, we can do things a lot faster and a lot better than we could when I was born, and I'm working more now than I ever did before. And so are all of us. And statistically, Americans now work more than ever, and they work more than anybody in the world. So we're not benefiting by all of these advances, everything we can do faster. So clearly, you know, better off is kind of a relative term. The middle class has now finally shrunk. The Pew report that shows that we're now a minority, the middle class Americans are in a minority, and that most Americans think life is going to be not better for their children, but worse for the first time ever. So, I mean, I wonder what this does mean in terms of broader restructuring. How do we create a society that allows us all to really benefit by the great technological possibilities that we can create? I mean, is that part of what you're looking at in this process?
We're certainly going to be asking those questions, although I'll be the first to say that we don't think that we have a bunch of good answers yet. We've got some speakers who will share some fairly provocative ideas, none of which have been implemented anywhere successfully in the world. I think what's really important today, and it certainly was true a week and a half ago when the World Economic Forum met in Davos to talk about this very same issue, is that we begin to have these conversations and we begin to think about what kinds of public policies can help us develop some amount of resiliency and support for our people.
Martin, what do you think? How does the future look to you?
Well, like I say, I think that, you know, this is the primary challenge. I think that it's a conversation that we're all going to have over the next 10, 20 years as this unfolds. And there are some things that can be done at the local level in terms of education and so forth, but clearly this is not, you know, a North Carolina scale problem. This is really a global problem. And so ultimately it's going to require a conversation at a minimum on the national level, and probably will, I think, require some whole scale changes to our entire system.
Well, yeah,
having said all of that, I do want to say, but North Carolina wants to be the best positioned state coming out of whatever happens.
And I'm sure we will be. I want to thank you both for being on the program. Martin Ford, founder of a software technology firm in Silicon Valley and the author of Rise of the Robots, Technology and the Threat of a Jobless Future. Martin, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you.
Anita Brown Graham is the director of the Institute for Emerging Issues at NC State. This year's Emerging Issues Forum is next Monday and Tuesday. Registration for the forum ends today, and you can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. Anita, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Frank.
Just ahead, we'll hear about the life and music of composer Joel Wallach on The State of Things. Stay tuned.